You are listening to a PERC podcast brought to you by the Property and Environment Research Center in Bozeman, Montana. This episode features Jonathan Click offering a summary and closing remarks for PERC's financial contracting, transaction costs, and environmental amenities conference.
So, there are lots of things that I could talk about. You know, clearly Kent wants to hear more about CDMs, but that's probably best left for another day. so we're not going to go in that direction. But in some ways, to sort of close things down, I want to bring things back to where we started with Karpoff. A couple of days ago, unfortunately, John has left us. But John sort of put on his Pope hat, right? And he did something quite amazing and I think not quite legal under canon law, but he canonized Coase. So we've got that there. As an aside, when I was at the table this morning putting together the slides, my kids are sitting around and say, "Jesus, Dad, what do you do at work?" Right? I just goof around, right? That's a big thing. But he canonizes Coase, and as a product of 16 years of Catholic schooling, and remembering what Sister Genevieve told me in the third grade back in the early 1980s, I'm pretty sure Karpoff can't do that, right? I wasn't positive, so I had to go check, and so we have the great canon legal scholar Father Guido Sarducci, and he reminds us that in order to be a saint, you've got to have at least three miracles. Now, he did note that with American saints, you usually can cut the edges a little bit. You know, this is from a famous text that he wrote in the late 1970s. It was right after St. John Neumann was canonized. And that was only a year after you had Mother Seton canonized. And so he was kind of griping as an Italian legal scholar. He was kind of griping. He said, with Americans, they just wanted to have so many more saints. And so you could count things like card tricks and stuff for American saints in your three miracles. So I was trying to think, what are Coase's three miracles? And it took me a while. But Karpoff gave us some hints, right? He got Friedman and Stigler to change their minds. That probably counts as a miracle. More important than a card trick, for sure. No. See, you got to go back to your canon law, So that's at least one miracle. Second miracle, well, this one's near and dear to my heart. He invents law and econ, right? So how is it that the guy who was stealing PBRs from his dad's refrigerator, makes it to a fancy law school was only because law and econ is invented, right? So I'm willing to count that as a miracle for sure. What's the third one, though? Right? He's 101. Does that count as a miracle? Well, you have to be dead to be a saint, so that can't be a miracle. Furthermore, if we go back to Sister Genevieve, it's the best picture I could find of her. She herself, when she was teaching me in the early 80s, was at least 115. So she certainly wouldn't have counted that as a miracle. So we take that one off there. But anyway, so what I tried to do is try to think of the Coasean elements here. We're at PERC. Coase is obviously one of the most important folks. What were the sort of Coase and Ariadne's threads that go through these papers? And so we started out, the hardest working man in showbiz, James Brown. He's telling us about these financial mechanisms to sort of do the funding for the green projects, and that is very Coasean, right? You have these potential transactions costs that keep you from realizing important gains. One way to sort of solve them is through financial innovation. Another way to solve them is through the firm. I think that's very Coasean. It's a good perspective to keep going forward, right? What do we think about these environmental innovations in terms of a theory of the firm framework? For Robin tells us about, it's a course for running firms and for picking public policies and things like that. Information costs are one of the important costs in sort of doing these things. And Coase in the theory of the firm was all about, is it cheaper to do these things within the firm? Is it cheaper to go to the market? But Robin's sort of giving us some insights into how both of those kinds of costs might be able to be reduced through these prediction markets. So that's a good perspective to keep going on. with Mike Orlando, that's really more of a Williamsonian kind of paper, which of course draws sort of its origins from Coase, although Oliver and Coase didn't always get along in print for sure. Although as a law and econ guy, you know, my favorite Coase-Williamson combination is back in the early 80s when they both got beaten up by Posner, so they came back and they just killed him in Journal of Institutional and Theoretical Economics. So so I count sort of a Williamsonian idea as really sort of a Coasean idea, and so thinking about how we can sort of think about transactions costs and think of financial products or legal institutional products, how can we minimize those transactions costs to get done what we want to have done? And when we get to Kent, right, this is Coase in action, right? You have people with seemingly oppositional interests, and they can't seem to get it together until a guy like Kent comes in, right? And he sort of, as the intermediary, lowers the transactions costs or even gets rid of them. And he gets to an end point where, everybody's happy, right? We get sort of the property in the hands where it's sort of most valuable. Kent is really sort of a Coasean hero as well. So it's good to know that these ideas actually have practical and valuable outcomes associated with them. Rick, his biggest Coasean connection is he took the pledge, right? You can't hope for better than that. He took the pledge and he will no longer utter the word externality again. And we'll keep an eye on him for that for sure. But of course, his paper is all about sort of Coasean ideas, right? You have people with vested interests, but it's not quite the optimal use of the property or the institutions. And so his paper is all about how can we have the right payoffs? How can we get the payoffs done? How can we get the holdouts to stop holding out? And then we get to Frank's paper. This really highlights the importance of property rights. Here we have a system that technically and economically could generate huge improvements, and we sort of are stuck to some extent on the problem of ambiguous property rights. And so that's sort of highlighting some of the same problems that Coase himself was highlighting. Now with the paper today, that's not so much Coase, right? It's Adam Smith, right? Growth is everything, right? How do we fix growth? And Coase would be fine to say that somebody looked at Adam Smith instead of him, right? So I'm perfectly happy with that. These are all sort of important perspectives, and I'm not going to say that they're absent in sort of the current environmental literature, but they're certainly underplayed. If you look at sort of environmental economics, it's an important area for sure. There's lots written in it. But sort of your standard environmental economics paper are the kinds of papers that we often see here at PERC through other programs, right? People throw up sort of a dynamic optimization problem. They say, here's the way things ought to be. Let's take some data. We're not going to actually estimate anything. We're going to calibrate it, and we're going to come up with some fairly complicated results. And, sure, that's the way science moves. We sort of move forward in small increments. And I'm not saying that stuff's not helpful. But note, if we contrast it to sort of the other areas of economics that over the last, say, decade or decade and a half that have really grabbed the public's attention and has really grabbed policymakers' attention and has really made sort of improvements in public policy, it's not that kind of approach, right? What are the big winners in economics in terms of fields in the last couple of years for sure? Most of the big policy improvements have come from what we generally call sort of labor economics, right? An area that I work in, crime, has really been sort of the gold medalist in the last couple of years in terms of coming up with credible results that actually change people's opinions, that actually change policy, right? So if you go back, the two decades or the decade and a half, we didn't know anything about crime, right? If you went and looked in criminology journals, there was a whole bunch of just gobbledygook. Nobody believed it. Nobody paid attention to it. If you looked in economics journals, there wasn't even that much done. Then what happens? Steve Levitt comes on the scene, 1997. He writes a paper with a really clever way to sort of get around the problem of, what causes crime? How do we fight crime? And he was particularly looking at police. Now, his creative idea was really helpful. It sort of pushed the field forward. It turned out to be wrong. He screwed some things up. You know, that tends to be a theme in Steve's work. But it doesn't suggest that he's not helpful, right? I mean, he pushes people forward in terms of thinking about these design kinds of questions. And so what happens post-Leavitt, right? We have about 24 papers. You know, we can count even more if we go beyond police and crime. But we have a bunch of papers that take really neat identification strategies, right? And they figure out. They figure out, you know, what is the effect of police on crime? You know, so you've got, we've got a paper looking at police increases due to terrorism concerns in Washington. We come up with an elasticity. There's, you know, some other people do the same thing in Argentina. They come up with an elasticity. You've got some other people taking other kinds of shocks, other kinds of designs. And everybody, what happens, right? These are all pretty good designs. They're all different designs. Not to say that any of them are perfect, but they're all imperfect in different ways, and yet they all hit on the same number, right? What happens? The public policymakers, they all start to listen. Not only because we came up with sort of better research designs and because we sort of converged on what appears to be the right answer, but furthermore, because each of those research designs was intuitively understandable, right? Well, you didn't have to talk about, well, you know, we calibrated this and we calibrated that, right? We said, well, look, you know, one day there's so many police in District 1 of Washington, D.C., and there's a certain amount of crime. Then the next day, Homeland Security says, you know, Al-Qaeda's afoot, right? And so all of a sudden, there's twice as many police in that area of the city. And so we can compare. People can understand that, right? My dad can even understand that after a few PBRs. That's the test, right? And so public policymakers can understand that. And so what has happened since we've done that? I don't know if there's no reason you all have been paying attention to that, but we went from an environment where people on the public policy level were saying, look, we got to build more prisons, et cetera, to a world where they're starting to say, well, no, cops are a way better bang for the buck, right? It's actually changed the public policy discussion. I think it's because of these better designs, but also more intuitive designs. And I think that's the way environmental economics needs to go, too, if it's going to make progress. Now, you might say, you know, there are these sort of methodological differences and say, well, look, there's some problems with those kinds of designs. That may be true. There's problems with other kinds of designs, too. But the really great thing about these kinds of designs is, again, your congressman can understand them. The reporter can understand them. And that makes a big difference. We heard that, you know, a couple of minutes ago. Can you explain this stuff? And that stuff's way more sort of explainable. So I think it was really sort of a good move on Dino's part to sort of mix people in here who aren't sort of your general environmental economics folks, people from different perspectives who can maybe bring something new to the table. And I think that's a really useful thing, and hopefully we see more of that. Not to say that this should push out other approaches in the field. You know, in the best of all worlds, these are sort of complementary approaches. It's one of the bad things about economics is you tend to see fields become dominated by one approach versus the other. And if you use the other approach, you're kind of you know, cut out of the field. So hopefully these things can be complementary. Now, can this work in environmental? Well, it's interesting. If you go and ask non-environmental people, you ask other kinds of economists that hardly ever read environmental stuff, right? What environmental papers do you know? Which papers do they say, or which authors do they point to? Michael Greenstone, right? Everybody knows the Michael Greenstone papers on climate change and other kinds of environmental stuff. What does Michael do? Michael doesn't do the standard stuff that's done in environmental stuff, right? He takes these sort of more intuitive approaches, and, you know, whether they're better or worse or get to the right answer, you know, that's important for sure, but people listen to that, right? Sure, it helps to be Michael, but, you know, it also helps that he's sort of doing something fairly intuitive. Right? He says, you know, look, here's the natural experiment that we're going to look at, right? Same thing with the Ken Che papers, right? Ken, who's really a health guy, does some environmental stuff, and if you look across economics generally, you know, those are the papers regular economists know, that non-environmental economists know. The Janet Curry stuff that Rick sort of noted the other day. Same thing. You know, Janet's a health person, comes in and does environmental stuff, sort of takes these other kinds of tools. And what do you know? All of a sudden, people know these papers, right? And I can tell you from having done policy stuff myself, still doing policy stuff, it's lots easier to explain these kinds of papers and results, and it generates a lot more persuasive power and confidence to non-economists and certainly non-specialists in the area. Right? So I think there's really a lot of ground to be made here in terms of where it matters, right? The public policy changes. And so I really sort of hope that PERC in particular, and maybe the field more generally, becomes more ecumenical, becomes more Catholic with a small c in that kind of approach. So last night, to sort of shift gears a little bit, Robin sort of asked me, he said, I came sort of late to whatever group he was with. He said, I asked these other guys, what's a big question, right? I'm interested in a big question. We can for 20 minutes or whatever. And they failed. They couldn't give me sort of a sufficiently interesting question. I said, well, you know, Robin, I'm not a big question kind of guy, right? I'm a small question kind of guy. And he pushed me, which was good. And we came up, and I'm not so sure I came up with any better of a big question, but it kept the awkward silence at bay for 10 minutes or so. So I count that as a victory. but it sort of pushed me to sort of think about maybe not big questions, but maybe medium-range questions, or at least medium-range puzzles in this area. And the one that sort of I would like to sort of talk about at the end here, maybe get a discussion going, not so much because the answer to the question is important, although maybe it is, but maybe sort of by fleshing out this question, we can sort of hit upon what are some of the important ignored transactions costs in this general kind of area. And if we can figure that out, maybe we can make some progress in lots of areas. So the puzzle that I had is, given how important climate change is, and given the concerns, and given the science in the area, why haven't we seen any reinsurance products created in this area? The reinsurers have complained about climate change, shake their fist, right? Now, they do more than that. They go to different governments and they say, look, you need to do these kinds of policies because, you know, if you don't, that's going to cause problems for our other products, right? And they also sort of push for some social insurance to cover the kinds of things that they explicitly exclude from their own products. But one would think if you've got such a big dollar amount on the line that there would be plenty of reasons for the big reinsurers to come up with a product, right? And it's interesting. This is in some ways, you know, maybe in other ways it's not, and I guess that's the presumption since these products don't exist. But in some ways, this is a product that ought to be easier to create than some of the products that reinsurers currently are investigating or have already launched. Why do I say that? Well, in addition to just having sort of standard reinsurance mechanisms in this case, right? So you know, you get the 10 reinsurers together. They say, look, you know, you this time take, you know, the first 20%, and in this other tower, you put the next 20%. You know, the normal diversification approach of reinsurance. Here, you also have potentially, it seems to me, based on some of the models, you have a pretty, or at least potentially helpful hedging mechanism. Right, so if you know, I don't want to steal any of his thunder, but JB this afternoon in his sort of PERC workshop is going to talk about, well, what should the law do perhaps with respect to the winners from climate change, or you know, what should we do about property rights from the guys who in expectation might actually gain from climate change, right? And you've all sort of seen the models, and intuitively you can sort of think, yeah, South Florida might be screwed, the coast might be screwed, but you know, winemakers in Oregon and Washington, they might be really happy, right? Things may be really great for them. Farmland in Alberta, people who own that might be really happy, right? It's maybe one of the few times that Canada's the big winner. It makes me feel sick in my stomach, right? Because
Canada,
you're,
I don't like it.
You're Canadian. You left. Revealed preference. You agree, right? No, but it makes me sick in my stomach, right? Because as a child, I don't think I was drinking PBR at the time, but you know, sitting in 1993 watching Joe Carter hit the home run to beat my beloved Phillies, so that's where it comes from, right? No, but even the pension, not just reinsurance, gains from diversification for the reinsurers, you might actually have an interesting hedging strategy here. right? And so why what seems like, at least on some important margin, seems like a really valuable product, why doesn't it exist? You might say, well, they're probably working on it. No, I've gone and talked to the reinsurers, right? They're like this with respect to climate change. They say, well, to the extent we're worried about climate change, right, we're thinking about it in terms of our existing products, right? How can we do things like lobby governments to have sort of a backstop for the exclusions that we write into our policies? Or in that case, that would be primary insurers. But it's the same kind of thing. Reinsurers worry about that, too. They say to governments, why aren't you doing more? But when you ask these reinsurers about product development, they're saying, no, look, we're out of this. We're not doing anything on this front. And you might say, well, look, climate change is hard for a lot of reasons. That's why they're staying away from it. You might say, well, look, even though we've got sort of models that are powerful for some purposes, they're just not very good for this purpose. Maybe that's plausible, right? And if you look at some of the models, while you can tell under different scenarios who might the winners and losers be, it's hard to sort of match those up particularly well, right? So there are some problems with the models. But that shouldn't be enough to stop product development. Why do I think this? Well, I'll give you some illustrations of products that have way worse models, and yet the reinsurers have either developed them or they're currently investing sort of millions in trying to develop them. So about 7 or 8 years now ago, ignore the picture for a moment. About 7 or 8 years ago, RMS calls me. RMS is Risk Modeling Services. It's a company that basically comes up with models for insurers and particularly reinsurers to use to figure out what the risks are and how to price them and things like that. And they said, John, we want to develop a model for litigation risk, right? We're talking catastrophic litigation. We're talking asbestos-type litigation risk. Right? We got all these crazy state courts out there, and they're going to turn all these claims that nobody thinks are sensible into these big giant class actions or big giant mass tort claims. And our clients or our customers are basically coming to us and saying, we want to insure against this risk, right? But the product doesn't exist. There are some litigation insurance products. Most of them have to do with paying for the litigation itself, not paying the judgment, right? But our clients say, we actually want protection against asbestos litigation risk. And they said, quit your job at Florida State. Leave Tallahassee, come work for us. Put together this. We know you've done lots of litigation empirical work. You're one of the 6 guys who does stuff with this data and has a JD, and so we think you're the guy. And I thought about it for a couple of days, and I went back to him, and I said, this just isn't going to work, right? The data are just awful. Why do I say that? Well, if you think anything about litigation, right, you know we've got data on about this many of the cases. Why? Well, because in torts cases, for example, 95% of cases settle, right? Furthermore, they settle with confidentiality agreements in them. If some insurer has some of the data, the other insurers aren't going to be willing to share, and in fact, antitrust laws stop that, right? And so putting together the data is just not feasible in this area, right? Furthermore, to the extent that we've got any theoretical ideas about what causes courts, particularly state courts, to make different decisions, to change what they say. Take tobacco litigation, right? Who else? Is anybody else in here? Laura, you're a lawyer, right? So you take first-year torts, and if you go through first-year torts, and then you think about tobacco litigation, you say, oh, this is an easy exam question. They don't even put this kind of exam question on a place like, Penn's torts exam. This is a no-brainer. This is assumption of risk, right? Everybody knows that. There's nothing here. And in fact, that's what the courts did essentially for 3-4 decades, right? They said, this is assumption of risk. Everybody knows this. There's a Surgeon General's report. Before that, you had sort of other reports. This is a no-brainer. So they all got thrown out. Then what happens? Well, one day, a Florida judge says, I don't know. Let's see if this sticks. And what happens? The tide turns completely, right? And so then tobacco companies start losing everywhere, right? How do you predict that? We didn't have a good model of that. So I tell the RMS guys, there's nothing here, Right? You can't do it. They said, well, thank you very much. And it turns out that after they went to me, they went to this guy, who will remain nameless, although enough of you in the room know who he is. Just by general descriptive terms, he's the shorter, thinner, balder version of me, right? And in fact, he co-authors with me enough, we might as well be the same person, okay? Don't tell him I said that, right? Because I like to lord it over him that I'm at a fancy law school and he's at a liberal arts college that nobody, you know, east of California ever heard of, right? But he might as well be me, right? So it makes sense that RMS goes to him. And they go to him and sort of not his academic employer, but his secondary employer, his moonlighting employer. And they make the same pitch to them, right? Who's that employer? Well, you know, back in the 40s and 50s, it was the place that came up with all the game theory stuff to figure out who to drop bombs on. I won't go any further than that. But they also have a civil justice organization of which this guy at the time was the head of or the associate head of. And they made the same pitch to these guys. They said, look, our clients really want this product, and we want to put lots of money in it, and we're going to hire you, and before you say no like Click did, we're going to make you an even sweeter deal than we made him. You can have half ownership of the product, right? And so they quickly said, well, we don't want to have half ownership of the product in the current organization. We're going to create another organization where we can all share in these grand delights. And so for the last 7 years, they've been working on this product. You might think, well maybe, you know, he's smarter than I am, or maybe they had more access to data than I did. Well, I check in every now and again with him about how this project's going. And so I did so when I started thinking about this. And I said, so are the models better now? Do you guys have new data? And he just started died laughing, right? He said, we're not coming up with a model. We're coming up with like two or three categories, and we're hoping they're right. And, you know, Munich Re and these other reinsurers seem to be interested, right? Now, I'm not going to say whether this is a good thing or a bad thing, but it's just as an example of these reinsurers are plenty happy to move into areas even where the models aren't very good, right? So by that thought, I would have thought that sort of the climate change models would be way better than the litigation models, for sure. So I'm not so sure it's just that the models aren't good enough. So it's got to be something else. We'll keep EH here looking over our shoulder. I always feel more comfortable when he's around. So what else is there? Are there any other examples? Well, around the same time, RMS also went to this guy's organization, not to him, to another guy in the organization and said, our clients are really interested in a terrorism product, right? There are terrorism insurance policies, but most of the stuff excludes the big kind of terrorism that we'd think about, right? So most standard policies have exclusions for nuclear, biological, chemical sort of attacks, anything that we would think would be sort of catastrophic. Our clients really want that. And so they hired, again, people from this organization, and they have been working for even longer, you know, a couple of years longer, on this terrorism product, right? Now, if you think the climate change models are bad, and I know the litigation models are bad, the terrorism models, they don't even exist. They're just awful, right? The data is terrible. You know, give you an example. Steve Levitt, I don't know if any of you who ever followed his blog or, you know, stuff like that, he was on a big kick, you know, when he was at the height of his fame. He was on a big kick saying, you know, look, I'm gonna do enough data mining. I'm going to figure out terrorism, right? We haven't heard anything from that in 7, 8, 9 years. And it's not because I know with reasonable certainty, it's not because one of the companies came in and sort of scooped him up and said, all right, be quiet, right? It's because there's nothing there in the data, right? And yet the reinsurers are pushing on developing this product. So if it's not the data, what else is different about climate change? If it's not the models? Maybe it's something about how concentrated the risks are. But that's why reinsurers exist, right? So I'm not so sure that's quite right. You might say, well, but this is even more concentrated than any of the other stuff that you can think of. Maybe, but then that should suggest that as more reinsurers enter the business, there's a higher likelihood that we have enough towers, so to speak, to cover this climate change kind of product. And in the last number of years, there's been a huge explosion of the number of reinsurers, or at least quasi-reinsurers in the business. That is to say, there have been lots of hedge funds over the last 5 years who have decided, for whatever reason, probably the fact that reinsurers, if you look at their financial data, they kind of make like 30% profits year after year. That's probably what induced this. But lots of hedge fund guys have said, okay, we're now going to be in the reinsurance business, right? And yet we still haven't seen any movement on these climate change products. So, you know, maybe it's concentrated risk, but I'm a little bit skeptical there too. Maybe it's salience, right? This is a possibility that a friend of mine who does sort of behavioral law and economics and insurance law at Georgetown, real smart guy, and he said, what do the behavioral law and econ guys always say? They would say salience, right? People they see the World Trade Center fall down, and so that makes them worried about insurance, worried about terrorism. Or they see Merck getting nailed, for its Vioxx product, and so they worry about class actions and mass torts and things like that. But we haven't really seen climate change, or at least not sort of in a salient way. Maybe, right? Maybe it's something like that. Although it's interesting, if you go and talk to real estate investors and developers in Florida, for example, you know, they are worried about this, right? If I were in Florida still, I'd be worried too, right? If you know, Dino's been trying to fix the insurance system in Florida for the last couple of years. Good luck with that, buddy, right? It just ain't going to happen. What happened after the big hurricanes when Governor Christ was in office? He said, you know, it's really not fair that these millionaires on the coast in Miami are paying so much in insurance. So what we're going to do is we're just going to have the state insure them, right? If you're a real estate developer, in the short term, you think that's great. But in the long term, you're thinking, I'm pretty sure if something bad happens, certainly on the scale of climate change, Florida's going to be bankrupt, right? And so if I had sort of another opportunity to insure, I kind of would love it, right? So maybe it's salience, but there are reasons to think there are troubles there. Maybe it's some kind of problem with, what kind of time scale we're talking here, right? If you look at the models when does the really bad stuff happen, it's sort of fairly far out. Maybe that has to do with salience, but maybe it also has to do with sort of financing problems and, what is it that investors want to want to do with their money? Do they really want something that's a 50-year product or a 100-year kind of investment? Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. But, I think this is sort of an interesting question, particularly for a conference like this, right? Environmental finance, right? We talked about lots of important questions and lots of ways that finance could maybe make a difference in sort of economic transactions and sort of financial concerns. But relative to climate change, they've all been pretty small, right? Not to say that fixing them isn't going to improve welfare a lot, but relative to climate change, these are really small, right? Let's take Robin's cue and let's try to think a little bit bigger on this. And let's try to think of what's the missing thing here, or what's the problem, what's the transaction cost here? And so I'll leave us with that. Hopefully maybe we can have a little bit of discussion before people leave. I don't have any strong ideas, right? I mean, I've thought about it for a little while now, and I've got sort of more questions than answers for sure. But maybe by pushing on this big question, great, maybe if we solved it, we all get rich, right? But even short of that, if we sort of push on the problems here, maybe it's going to give us some insights into the transactions problems in other areas too. So,
excellent.
Thank you.
Thank you, John.
To learn more about the conference and free market environmentalism, visit www.perc.org.